Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, what's up there? Dan here, a.k.a. The Comic Concierge, and this is my top 10 comic book video where I go through all the books I've read in the past week and pick out my top 10 favorites. But before I get into the good, I do like to discuss the bad, or more appropriately, the disappointing, as I talk about my most disappointing book of the week. And the thing with this, just because a book is disappointing doesn't necessarily mean it was bad. Sometimes it does. In this case, I wouldn't necessarily say this was a bad issue. In fact, you can check out my full review of this issue at comicscrusaders.com, and it's Spider-Man Shadow number 5. And this was the kind of different take on the What If idea. Of course, we're getting the What If TV show on Disney Plus right now. This, though, where What If typically in the past was a one-shot, a one-and-done issue, this was a 5-issue miniseries, and this series centered on the idea of basically what if Spider-Man became Venom, which we've seen different variations of that idea play out in the past, but I think this one went even further with it. And why was I disappointed in this issue? Well, in general, what I thought like this series really suffered from was the two first issues I thought were really strong and came out extremely fast, and the general idea of seeing Peter Parker become Venom was intriguing. But I felt the fallout of that, the way they dealt with repercussions, wasn't nearly as well crafted. I don't want to give any spoilers. I'll just say I felt the fact that Peter Parker did some really irreprehensible things in this series, and the way that they dealt with those, the consequences, felt a bit too clean for me. And they weren't critical enough of the character, or he didn't really have to have any major repercussions for the choices that he made. It almost seems like those choices were out of his control, when the entire premise of this issue was just against that, where it was him making a different choice than the choice he made in the past. So, it to me, like, you had a great idea there, interesting concept, and it didn't, to me, go deep enough with this final issue, which was what I was really hoping for. I thought the art was okay, nothing necessarily fantastic. I thought there was really inconsistencies in the faces, especially the way Invisible Woman was drawn, and there was just lack of dynamicism with the art. I utilized a lot of the same camera angles. It didn't really move the camera around that much. And ultimately, I just thought like it could have been a better issue. I did think the characters were well represented, and strangely enough, to set up potentially future issues, which could hopefully enhance or fix some of my problems. But as a finale to this idea, I don't necessarily feel like we got much more out of this being a 5-issue miniseries than we would if it was just a 1-issue one-shot. So we'll see what happens with the other What If new series that's coming out shortly. Well, enough about the bad. Let's talk about the good by looking at my number 10 for this week. For this week is White number 2, and I know a lot of the conversation behind this book has unfortunately not been about the content of the book itself, because it seems like people are just talking about how the first issue was in a limited series and they couldn't find a lot of issues. But now that the first issue has been reprinted and the second issue is out and they're available digitally now, you can all read them, and you really should. And although this is a continuation series of the Black series previously, which was about this idea that this exists in a world where the only people that have powers are Black people, and often they find out about those powers after a tragedy. For example, the first issue opens up where an individual is killed by the police, wakes up in an ambulance to discover the fact that he actually is indestructible, and there's this entire world of superpower people living in the underground. And after many series and some other mini series, we see that underground has become more known. And this series, this White series, has actually been focusing on the government, as Caucasians, white people, are still in charge of a lot of the political institutions. And this issue in particular, I think, kind of showing the new dynamic and the attempt of that government to find ways to, you know, take control against these individuals. And we've seen similar ideas like this play out in things like X-Men, for example. You know, X-Men, you know, since its creation, was one that was clearly coming from a world of looking at civil rights, and this is taking that idea and really not at all trying to be subtle about it, but making very interesting points. And the thing with a book that is clearly attempting to be political is well, is there a good story there as well? And I think that is certainly the case, because I do love a lot of these characters, and there's a lot of moving pieces within this. There's some, you know, celebrity cameos as well, but this was basically a party that went wrong. There was a celebrity gala that kind of went chaotic, and some characters made some bad choices that ended up having some serious repercussions. And the stakes here, I think, are very consistent. The question is, can you pick up White number 1 and number 2 and follow them without reading the previous Black series? I think you can. I think there's enough. There's enough context there to understand the main theme in this story, as well as the fact that a lot of the major characters in this first debut in this, so it's not like they have a long history. But I do think those previous series, and there's a few miniseries as well, give this world a further context. And I do have to say, I love seeing Jamal Ingalls art anytime. I would love the book, for example, The Wrong Earth, that he was working on. He really has a knack for, you know, showcasing superheroes and in a realistic world, and he does it here in spades. So definitely advise checking this out if you want to read a comic that has something to say as well as having a good story behind it. Definitely think White would be up your alley. Number 9 for me for this week is Fantastic Four Life Story number 3. And this is a continuation. Again, this is almost like a what-if story as well, similar to the Spider-Man Life Story, where they're seeing the Fantastic Four age in real time. This issue taking place in the 80s. And I think what this issue worked with well with me is because it had a lot of strong character moments, but I like it how it integrated into the actual history of the 1980s. And I was wondering, like, what would be the major event, you know, that it would link to? Because there's, you know, you're talking about an entire decade. And makes sense, the fact that this was actually dealing with Star Wars. No, not the movies, but the missile defense system that was being designed at that time due to the Cold War and issues with the Soviet Union. And what you see is Reed Richards trying to prepare the United States government not for Soviet takeover, but the fact that Galactus is coming and trying to get people to realize that there's this ominous threat that we should be focused on, you know, not pointing things at ourselves. You know, there's a great line about how, you know, only a fool points a gun at their own head. And I think it, you know, certainly showcasing the idea of how even when you have existential threats of aliens and things like that, you're still kind of focused on the wrong thing in a lot of ways. And again, then there's some really strong character moments here. This is an issue that's completely narrated by, or mostly narrated by, Johnny Storm. So you're seeing his perspective throughout this. And I love the way that they portrayed him, because, you know, Johnny Storm was always the kid, right? And now, you know, 20 years later, he's a little bit older, a little bit wiser. He's got a pretty interesting relationship with Franklin Richards, who clearly is dealing with his own trouble. And he's in high school trying to deal with his own powers, figuratively and literally. His parents are still separated, and then that also is a big issue within this. So there's a lot of moving pieces there. And these life stories are difficult to kind of do in a lot of ways, because there's a lot that is done off the page. In the sense of, you know, you're going from the 70s, the 80s, and what happened in between. How can you kind of showcase, you know, what happened in the missing years? And I thought it did a really good job of that. Last Fantastic Four stories are ones that are about family, and this is that, but in a different direction. There's some nice moments between Reed Richards, Ben Grimm, and Johnny Storm, and I like the fact that Ben Grimm and Johnny Storm's relationship has matured in a bit, like it would. I mean, sure, they might pull pranks on each other here and there, or getting on each other's nerves, but not to the extent it was 20 years ago. Now they've grown as individuals, and this is also a different version of those characters as well. And also, the ending of this I did not see coming, and it was actually much more emotional than one would expect. And, you know, wondering where this is going to lead us in the 90s and so on, because there's some major ramifications at the end of this issue that are going to, like, forever change the Fantastic Four, at least in this world. So if you're a Fantastic Four fan, I definitely would advise checking this out. But even if you're not a Fantastic Four fan, you just like to see, you know, Marvel comics or comics integrated into regular U.S. history or history in general, this might actually intrigue you as well. Number 8 for me for this week is Eve number 4. And I love how much the story has developed and changed throughout these four issues. The general premise started with this young girl who awakes, and she finds the world that she was living in was a dream world, and the actual Earth has basically been destroyed. It's a dystopian future. New York is underwater. However, with the help of a robot teddy bear, she's going to kind of go on this journey to potentially find her family and help save the world. It seems well enough, and I thought that her first issue was good, but now 4 issues in, that idea has completely changed. A lot has kind of been added to it and recontextualized just where we were at the beginning. I think it's going to be one of those series that's even better when you kind of reread it to see all the little hints that are there. And this has been a week of really strong familiar bonds between characters, and this one has one as well, with kind of a sisterly bond, but a different version of a sister bond. And I don't want to spoil it, I'll just say that we do see two characters really care for one another due to their kind of similar background. And I just thought those moments, taking the time to get the character moments like that, because a lot of times with a book like this, a dystopian journey, it's just go to the next big thing. But this has really taken time to take some breaths, have some good character moments to make those bigger crazy things happen. And there's a really odd and unique touching scene between two characters that have a lot of reason to hate each other, and maybe they do, but they also have this affection for one another. It's, I don't know, and there's an inevitability to the demise that's about to happen, and they're just kind of just sitting together waiting for that to occur, kind of putting things aside. And then, I don't know, it was a rather touching moment that, you know, for this really odd, unique book, was rather effective. So definitely by checking out Eve. I know there's so many different dystopian future books, but this is one of the better ones I've read in some time. Number 7 for me for this week is The Six Sidekicks of Trigger Keaton, number 3. I talked about some books this week that were more touching and moving and things like that. That's, although kind of had some moments here and there that might tuck on the heartstrings, this is just a really fun, enjoyable book. Chris Switzer and Kyle Starks make a fantastic team. I love when they worked on Mars Attacks a few years ago and how much better that book was than it had any business being. And the premise of this story is that Trigger Keaton is like the most annoying action star that was ever created. He was hugely popular, but pretty much anyone who worked with him hated him because he was brash. He was basically a jerk to everyone that he worked with. And one day he's found dead in his trailer. He hung himself, but a lot of the people that previously worked for him actually think that maybe it wasn't suicide, but it was murder. And it's been that must have been the mystery adventure that's in the background. That's the mystery that's kind of driving the narrative. But there's been so much else happening. And then there's been really fun character moments. There's been really just kind of outlandish craziness. Like, this has a huge bar fight. Actually, a few bar fights. A lot of these characters are characters with a capital C. You have, like, the big lumbering guy who loved Trigger Keaton, even though he was treated like garbage. A guy who kind of gave up on acting and became a nurse because of how bad it happened. Someone who's fresher, new into the world and hasn't been as kind of dehumanized as much as some of the other sidekicks because he just started working with them, and he's actually utilizing some of the kind of detective skills he learned preparing for roles in this mission. And then each week we kind of learn and new characters added to the fold, and they do a really good job of getting you an idea of who a character is right away. And at the end of the day, it's just really funny and enjoyable. It's never trying to take itself too seriously. The drama is very limited when it is there. It kind of comes and goes. It's a great palate cleanser. There's a lot of books this week that I've read that are pretty serious or pretty dreary. A book like this is one that's going to kind of put a smile on your face and realize that, you know, comics being funny books is not necessarily a bad thing. Number 6 for me for this week is Black Myth, number 2. And I really enjoy Ahoy Comics. I think they're one of those publishers that doesn't give enough credit for what they do, especially because they put a lot in a single issue outside of just the normal story. You get some short stories, you get sometimes even recipes, but what's usually the way that Ahoy goes is their books are kind of comedies first. For example, you know, you have Planet of the Nerds, Second Coming, things like Billionaire Island that tend to be, you know, comedy books, funny books. And this, I feel like, has comedic bits, but that's really second fiddle to just this central drama. This is kind of a combination of a crime story and a fantasy tale. It's a werewolf private eye, which may cause some people to roll their eyes, but it's actually working. I just actually really love the mishmashing of all these different supernatural elements. And usually me, I'm one that's like kind of put the supernatural to the side and just tell a cool human story. And that's kind of what this is doing, but in a way, by bringing everything in from like a minotaur to potentially vampires. And it's just a fun little world. And I think why it works for me is because of how matter of fact it is, in a way where you have a werewolf and you have a Minotaur that kind of is almost like a kind of like a glorified butler in a way. It deals with a lot of infamous myths as well. So if you're really into the classic fables or things like that, I think it really would be up your alley. I'm thinking of things like The Extraordinary Gentleman, for example. It has maybe more of a sardonic tone than some of something like that, and it's not, you know, doesn't have that Alan Moore flair. But if you like seeing like different elements from across literature kind of combined into one story, a lot of these aren't specific characters per se, but I think it has a similar idea of like, let's take things that are typically their own thing and bring them together and see how that works out. And so far, you know, this mystery right now is centering on missing silver bullets, trying to find out what, you know, what exactly is happening. And kind of like where it leaves off in the end. So I almost just dismissed this book because I looked at the premise thinking, like, I don't know if this is going to work for me. But I'm really glad I stuck with it because two issues in, I'm really enjoying this. Number five for me for this week is Daredevil number 33. Ever since Marco Checchetto and Chip Zdarsky have taken over this title, you know, 33 issues ago, it's been one of my favorite titles from Marvel and all of comics. Not every arc, not every issue has worked for me, but more often than not, it's been one of my favorite books of the week. And looking at this issue, you know, looking at it on paper, I would think this would be a really dumb issue. And maybe some of the stuff in here is pretty dumb. But just because it's dumb doesn't mean it can't work or can't be fun. It does seem like some of the worst things of the 90s coming back to haunt us, involving the character of Bullseye. Don't want to spoil it. I'll just say that, you know, he's become a bigger threat than ever before. And that's why I think it kind of works, because, you know, Elektra, who's now Daredevil, again, a thing that shouldn't work but is... To me, you feel how much of a threat this has become. Like, the fact that, like, it's like, oh, things are getting scary. Like, how do you get through this? You know, the stakes have quickly been raised. I love how she got out of it. Like, how she was able to make a choice where, like, okay, I'm not able to win this fight. What can I do? And that response, I thought, was kind of great. And there's also some other characters that have been prominent figures within this run coming back. And I love where it leaves off. We'll just see Daredevil in a very... peculiar situation, and that has me kind of intrigued moving forward. So again, like, looking at this comic on paper, like, you know, Elektra as Daredevil, Bullseye and what happens to him, even the ending, I'm like, this is gonna be one bad issue, but it all comes down to execution. And again, Marco Checchetto, I love the way he displays this world. I often really love his action sequences. He makes things really big and dynamic, and there's some action here, but especially in the beginning, but outside of that, it's much more of a character piece. You have a lot of moving pieces, and that's actually, and this issue just made me realize that there's a, you know, you have Kingpin, you have Elektra, you have regular Daredevil, you have some other undergoings with, you know, other relationships between Matt Murdock. There's all these different subplots going on, and it's been handled pretty well in the sense of it's still remained rather fluid issue to issue. So 33 issues in, I don't know if this is a great jumping on point, but I do think this is a great run if you want to pick up the trades. It's one of the best Marvel books I would advise you checking out. Number 4 for me for this week is Rorschach number 11. And going into this week, this was my most anticipated book of the week, so you'd think number 4 it would just be disappointing. And that's not necessarily the case. I just thought this week the other books I enjoyed a bit more. This is a lofty issue. This is, of course, the penultimate issue before the series comes to an end. And with that, this is the issue where, you know, we kind of learn everything. And definitely seems to be somewhat of the pattern with Tom King and his stories. Typically, the 10th or the 11th issue is when everything comes to a head, and we kind of then see the fallout with the next issue. But I love the way this issue is crafted. It's not the best issue of the series thus far, in the sense of how it kind of lays out its pages. But there's some really great moments in the sense of you have, you know, basically this detective looking at what happened and having a conversation with himself, but also conversation with the characters that he's also hunting or trying to determine what happened to them. And the way it kind of lays out on the page is sometimes you could read it in the sense of reading it all off his words as if like him talking to himself, or read it back and forth as if they're having a conversation, or just read them separately as well, and they work anyway, and that happens throughout. It just, again, finding cool and interesting ways to craft a story and to, again, get into the themes of the story as well as focusing on the narrative. That's what I've really loved about this book, is the way it's being able to find new and interesting ways to craft its tale. It's not always about just putting the plot on the page or focusing solely on that. It's like, how do I craft or provide this information in a unique and intriguing way, especially with an issue like this that has a lot of text. This is one of the issues that's going to take you some time to read. And I just thought the way it handled that conversation and how it tried to... Now, this is really just two people talking to one another throughout this issue. And that's a hard work for an artist to make that look interesting. And I thought Jorge Fornes, again, showing why, to me, this is the best thing he's done his entire career. And is maybe an artist that we don't really appreciate nearly enough, or an artist that's probably going to be, I think, an even bigger breakout star, is becoming one of the best in the game in the way he kind of can take an idea and craft it on the page. And I do think, again, I don't think we'll fully grasp everything that the story is about until we get the incomplete picture, the complete story with next issue, and go back and reread it all in one sitting, because this is a very dense read. There's a lot here, and I don't think even like reading it twice is enough. Not that you lack comprehension of the basic understanding of what's happening, but the deeper meaning and how things are connected, or even different aspects of the craftsmanship you may not even pick up on first read. I think it's one of those things where every time you read it again and again, there's something new for you to enjoy. For me for this week is the Silver Coin number 5. This was actually going to be the last issue of this series until it was switched to an ongoing, and every issue of the series has seen Michael Walsh partner up with a very talented writer, and that's the case here, although this is Michael Walsh partnering up with himself. So this is not Chip Zdarsky, this is not another known author, it's just him doing his own work. And I have to say, outside of the first issue, this might be my favorite issue of the series thus far. I do think, though, it does something I feel like I kind of get annoyed with comics, where comics feel like they always have to explain themselves, and I don't think that's always something you need to do. However, when it's done right, it's done right, and that's the case with this issue, because what this does is give us the origin of the silver coin to better understand where exactly did the silver coin come from, and why does it have the power it has. That's all revealed in this issue, taking us back to early English settlements, where, of course, you had things like this doesn't have the Salem witch trials, but it has a very similar feel to that. And it actually reminded me a lot of that movie in a few years ago, The Witch, that was very authentic to the time. This isn't to that level. This is not like they're speaking old English, but I do feel like it has this very similar tone. It also utilizes the goat in a very, very creepy way, and what you see is basically people trying to take out this witch and how she feels betrayed by one of her friends, and what that leads to, kind of your classic story of betrayal and how that sin can carry through generation to generation to generation. And that's happening here. This could have easily been the final issue of the series, and it would put a nice bow on it, but I am excited we're going to get more. And I think it also shows that Michael Walsh as a writer doesn't necessarily need other writers. He's just as good by himself as he is with someone more notable. I know that probably is going to give him more attention if you can attach a name to something, because of just the fact that there's so many comics out. I do hope that this series and its success makes him just as big of a name as some of the writers he brought on as well. Two for me for this week is Monolith number 5, and although I love this series, I'm very glad it's over, because, man, it is a wild ride, and I was so tense reading this issue. The concept of it is actually really simple. It's this mother who's kind of dealing with a lot of personal issues, decides to go off on a road trip, and she's taking her husband's car. It's this crazy future car that's almost like a Hummer meshed with a tank. It's got all the bells and whistles. Unfortunately, she finds herself lost in the desert. She gets locked out of the car. She can't get in. And because it is this futuristic car that you can't even break in, she's worried that her son's going to die of heat exhaustion because the sun is beating down and she can't get him out. And he's locked in a car seat. And it's been just basically this white knuckle ride for the last few issues of just seeing her try to get into this car. And this is the king of showing and not telling. With Rorschach, that was a book I think you could probably argue that was more tell, not show, just with how many words were on the page. But this, like, if you probably, you know, would barely get to double digits, you know, with the amount of words you'll read this issue, it was just, it was also beautiful art, had a very painterly quality to it. Last issue actually incorporated a lot of different styles because he was bitten by a snake. This doesn't have that touch, but in the sense of just how successful it was at ending this story, because this is also the final issue, I thought was also really powerful, because there's also there's such a great small moment at the end of it that tells you so much. It's just, it involves a picture, it's all I'll say, and it helps, I think, resolve a lot of the plot constructs that came in the first issue, where you saw her kind of dealing with a lot of mental anguish, and she just seemed like a lost individual. And what I think you see by the end is where that could lead to. I don't want to spoil anything, just say that it has a very distinct resolution, both internally and externally. So, a book I'd highly advise checking from Magnetic Press. It's hard to probably get a physical copy, but it is available on Comixology Unlimited. And Magnetic Press, you know, it just takes a lot of foreign comics or non-English-speaking comics and translates them, and they've been doing a fantastic job of finding great comics to shine a light on. Now, this may be one of my favorites that I've put out this year. Number one for me for this week is Bitterroot number 15, and it might sound weird since this is a book that actually has won Eisners and been nominated for Eisners, but I don't think we appreciate just how great this series is nearly enough. I don't think we talk about it nearly enough. I don't know why that is, but it's supremely underappreciated, I think, in the comic book world. And it's this unique story that takes place in the 1920s Harlem, where you have this family that fights off these, you know, different monster creatures. And this series, arc has actually seen them kind of go back in time between different timelines. And this brings everything to a head. It's actually the 15th issue is the kind of the finale of this entire story that's been building since issue one. So not necessarily a great point to jump on. This apparently, based upon the note in the back, it will be continuing. This is not the end of Bitterroot, but this is the end of this specific story. And I was actually really surprised where it went to at the end. So I don't know what the future is going to be like. Will we have these same characters? Will it be a different timeline? I'm not sure. But, you know, this was a week where there was a lot of books that had an emotional wall for one reason or another. But none came close to Bitterroot, and it wasn't because of a certain character death or character living or anything like that. It was the message, and I think this has a very important message that is vital for our times. And you know, it with that word Bitterroot, that idea of bitterness and the toxicity that can exist within a culture and in a world, and how exactly you fight that, and how it can't be fought with anger, and it can't be fought necessarily with violence. But how do you cure something like that? And, you know, they're fighting basically these evil trees, which may not seem like the most exciting things, but it's what it means and what it's trying to represent. And it also was fantastic art by Sanford Green. I read some comics, and you see so much space not being used. That is never the case with Bitterroot. Every inch of every page is utilized in some way. There's so much color on the page. And it also, like, utilizes a lot of textures. And, like, you almost see, like, ink splashes on the page that just give it so much life. And it's just, I love his designs, his characters. To me, you just see the character and you have an idea of the personality right away. It's great at that. There's so much unique art style within this series. Some of the best comics that are being published right now, either Image and in general. I do think Bitterroot needs to be in that conversation as one of the best. I don't know when it's coming back. I'll, you know, be waiting with bated breath to see it return. Like I said, if it were to end here, I think it would be fine because it is a fitting ending. I don't expect this to be my favorite book of the week, but it was one of those things. But by the end of it, it was an easy choice for me. But, you know, I was curious, though, what are your favorite books of the week? What did you read? Let me know in the comment section below. I know that there are a ton of different comic book channels out there, so I appreciate any view, any like, any comment. Thank you for any of that. Just remember that comics are for everyone. The key is finding a right one. Until next time, keep reading.
Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take 5 before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
My name's Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.